Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Richard Dawkins is with us, the world-renowned evolutionary biologist and equally renowned atheist. You know his books like The Selfish Gene, The God Delusion, and The Greatest Show on Earth. Now comes a fantastic graphic science book for readers of all ages. It's called The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True, written by Dawkins with designer Dave McKean. Dr. Dawkins, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
The Reality of Magic. And your first chapter is called What is Reality? What is Magic? Why does a scientific rationalist like you even broach the subject of magic?
I distinguish three kinds of magic. Supernatural magic, which is nonsense. Conjuring magic, stage magic, which happens and is interesting and is not mysterious because it's a trick. And the magic of reality, which is the sort of magic that you mean when you look up at the stars and say, what a magical sight, when you look at a sunset over the Grand Canyon, or when you look down a microscope, and you get a feeling of magicalness, but there's nothing supernatural about it.
Listeners, if you've always wanted to talk to Richard Dawkins, this will be your chance. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you've been inspired by him as a scientist or as a philosopher, if you think he denies the existence of God and you want to argue with him about that, we can do that. 212-433-9692 or post to our website, wnyc.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. All the chapters are questions, and many are concrete science questions like what is the sun and what is a rainbow, but some are the philosophical imponderables like why do bad things happen? Why did you include that kind of question in your book?
Why do bad things happen? Because there are a lot of people who have a sort of sense of natural justice, as though they feel that bad things should only happen to bad people and good things should only happen to good people. And of course, that's not the way that the world works. It's not the way the universe works. The universe is indifferent to good and evil. Things happen. Some of those things we deem to be bad with hindsight. Some of them we deem to be good.
Just change the title to Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People Like You, and you can have a hit self-help book. Why do bad things happen? What's the theme of that chapter?
Well, it goes into what's sometimes called Sod's Law or Murphy's Law. If a thing can go wrong, it will. If you drop a piece of toast and marmalade off the table, it always falls marmalade side down. That kind of automatic pessimism, and I deal with that. There's quite a bit about luck. And there are some people who actually believe that there are lucky people who are more likely to win a toss when you toss a coin to see what you should do. I actually had a newspaper cutting about a cricket match between India and Sri Lanka, in which somebody won a competition by saying that because the Indian captain had won the toss so many times, it was time the Sri Lankan captain won, and therefore he believed that the Sri Lankan captain was going to win the toss.
When really
there are people who just
still,
don't understand
it
chance.
It was still a 50% chance.
It's still a 50%. That's right, yes.
It reminds me of the experiment that somebody did that found that a chimpanzee throwing darts at a dartboard could pick stocks that would go up or down as accurately as the stockbrokers. But then a financial advisor, I heard, said, but they don't know when to sell. So Richard Dawkins with us. His new book is called The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. I want to get into the design of the book, which is amazing, in a few minutes. But I want to keep going through some of the questions that are the chapter titles. You also ask, as the title of chapter 3, why are there so many kinds of animals? And that's just an interesting science question, so I'll bite. Why are there so many kinds of animals?
Well, in evolution, under Darwin's theory of natural selection, what happens when a species splits into two is that usually they get separated by some kind of geographical accident. A population gets isolated on an island or in a lake. A lake's just a watery island. And once they've been isolated, they then can diverge in evolution. It takes maybe tens of thousands of years. And once they've diverged sufficiently, they can no longer interbreed again. And at that point, we can say we've now got two species where before we only had one. Now, every species on Earth, which is billions of species that have lived in the past, every species that's ever lived has come into existence as the splitting of an ancestral species. So we split from chimpanzees, for example, about 6 million years ago. We and chimpanzees, I should say, split from the common ancestor that we share with chimpanzees, because chimpanzees are just modern animals, just like us. We're all modern animals. Our common ancestor lived 6 million years ago. It split at that point, and one line of descendants gave rise to us and several other species. Another line of descendants gave rise to chimpanzees and bonobos.
So is the science that it all goes back to one amoeba or something from which this all began?
Well, not an amoeba, but probably something more like a bacterium, yes.
I'm trying to figure out how to talk about Dave McKean's illustrations on the radio. Every page includes awesome illustrations. Some pages have no text at all. Dave has illustrated top graphic novels by the likes of Ray Bradbury, Neil Gaiman. He's done hundreds of album covers and comic book covers, even designed characters for two of the Harry Potter movies. So this is very contemporary illustration with a pop sensibility in a science book. How would you describe the look of your book?
Well, I think I'd describe it as edgy. His pictures are quite superb, and reviewer after reviewer has singled them out for special praise. They go terribly well with the text, I think. He was great to work with, and I strongly recommend him as an artist.
The cover illustration has somebody, I won't say it's a person, it's certainly a biped, somebody standing upright on a rock at the top of a cliff or a mountain, maybe looking in at what, the Grand Canyon?
I think it's the Grand Canyon, yes.
And why that for the cover?
The magic of reality. I mean, standing on the edge of Grand Canyon, you get a real feeling of magic. But as I said at the beginning, it's nothing to do with supernatural magic. I think it is a human. It seems to have a backpack on.
Now that I look more closely. Yeah.
But it could equally well be one of our ancestors, except that in that case it wouldn't be Grand Canyon. It might be something in the Rift Valley in Africa, because, of course, that's where our ape-like ancestors came from.
The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True, is the book from Richard Dawkins. And a question from our comments page. What I want to know from Mr. Dawkins is, when is science going to wrap it all up, having answered every conceivable question left, so that we can finally rule out all supernatural possibility?
Well, I think we can probably rule out all supernatural possibilities already. But when is science going to wrap it up? That, I think, is really a question for physicists, because physics is presenting at the moment the big unanswered questions. We don't have to wait for science to wrap it up in order to conclude that supernatural explanations are nonsense. It's an open question whether science ever will wrap it up. Some physicists think we will, other physicists think we won't. But even if we don't, then we most certainly shall not need to resort to religion in order to understand.
Jim on our comments page writes, "Atheism is a religion. Being convinced of anything with respect to God requires an irrational faith in your knowledge of the universe. Only agnosticism can be defended as truly logical." I guess that's saying, I have no way of knowing whether there's a God or not. So how does Richard respond to that, asked Jim.
Well, non-belief in Mother Goose, non-belief in fairies is also a religion in that case, and of course it isn't. The onus is on people who want to believe in Mother Goose or fairies or God in order to bring forward at least some tiny shred of evidence in favor of them.
If there are other planes of existence that just exist outside of scientific reality, we would have no way of knowing it, would we?
If there are other things that exist outside scientific reality, then we have to broaden our concept of scientific reality. That would be a shortcoming in existing science, and we would need to improve our science, and it's happened before.
Your press materials say the book is for readers of all ages. What age group do you see this book as being for primarily?
When I wrote it, I had 12-year-olds in mind, but more and more I think it should be readable, it should be read. I hope it will be read by people of all ages up to 105 and down to perhaps about 8. Below that, maybe they would need help from parents or teachers.
I heard Salman Rushdie refer to you the other day. He said he is an atheist, but he's not a Richard Dawkins kind of atheist, because he thinks if other people find religion and the idea of God helpful to them, he doesn't care. Well, he characterized you as more wanting to rail against them and talk them out of it. And I'm completely paraphrasing here, but does that ring true as a description of you?
Well, I suppose in a way. I mean, there are a lot of people who say, well, you know, if people enjoy their religion, then why not let them have it? And of course, I agree with that. I mean, why not? Unless, of course, they then start pushing their religion on other people, which they do. And so you get people agitating in American school boards for the for the teaching of evolution to stop, and for, or at least for it to be accompanied by the teaching of fairy tales like intelligent design and creationism. So they do interfere. They don't just keep themselves to themselves. Even if they did keep themselves to themselves, I think I would still, in the nicest possible way, like to say to people, look, you're missing something, because the scientific worldview is so enthralling, so exciting, so fascinating, and it's getting better all the time. And so to go to your death without understanding the scientific view of why you exist at all would be tragic. You'd be missing something. You'd be losing something.
John from Orangeburg has a question for you on our website, a science question. It says, one of the principles of physics is that everything seeks a greater degree of entropy. Why then has evolution taken place by taking simple elements and building them into millions of highly complex organisms via DNA?
That characterization of the second law of thermodynamics assumes a closed system. And we are not dealing with a closed system here. We're dealing with a system in which the sun, mostly the sun, provides massive quantities of energy. And that is what's driving the whole of biological processes, including evolution.
That last question relates, I think, to one I wanted to ask about some of your older body of work. Your 1976 classic, The Selfish Gene, I think was so groundbreaking because it took a gene-centered view of evolution, arguing that genetic material, particular genes and genetic traits, are what causes evolutionary change or drives it, not evolution at the level of the whole organism. Do I have that about right?
Yes, pretty much. I think that's always been the view that biologists have taken since about the 1930s, when the neo-Darwinian synthesis married Mendelian genetics to Darwinian evolution. So the best way to look at evolution, the best way to look at natural selection anyway, is that natural selection chooses some genes rather than others. And the criterion by which genes get themselves chosen is by building bodies. And, of course, what the bodies actually do varies from species to species. But the general summary of what they do is that they keep the body alive long enough to reproduce and pass on the genes that made them do it.
So Brooklyn Mom 78 from Park Slope writes on our page, asks, in what ways do you feel modern society has influenced human evolution? And do you feel that some people are biologically predisposed to be religious while others are not? They're really two separate questions. So we think of evolution as such a slow, glacial pace kind of process. You know, we evolved from the common ancestor with the chimpanzees 6 million years ago, you said. Can you say that modern society is influencing human evolution?
Well, yes. It's probably by feather bedding us and making it rather difficult to die young, at least in countries that have proper medical care. That means that the cutting edge of evolution has been blunted. And so to that extent, human civilization has changed the course of evolution. It may not have caused it all, it may not have changed it all that much. But in any case, what we're seeing now is another kind of evolution, which is not genetic evolution at all, but cultural evolution, which is much, much faster and is extremely dramatic. And you can see it in the evolution of the car, the computer, the plane, etc.
But that's not really evolution.
No, it's not. I mean, it's something that looks a bit like it, but it's not genetic.
How about her second question? Do you feel that some people are biologically predisposed to be religious while others are not?
People are biologically predisposed to differ in all sorts of ways, and not many of them have been investigated. I would just say it's unlikely that religious impulse would be any exception to that rule.
You also argued in one of your books in the 80s that the impact of a gene is not limited to the body of the organism containing the gene, but can be felt extending out into the environment. Do you still believe that?
Yes, that was my book called The Extended Phenotype, published in 1982, which was really meant for a professional audience. But I'm glad to say it's been read very, very widely as well. And there's a summary of the argument of the extended phenotype in the second edition of The Selfish Gene. The kind of idea is that something like a beaver dam or a bird's nest is, although not exactly a part of the animal, can be treated as though it was a part of the animal because natural selection works on it in the same kind of way as it works on parts of the animal.
By the way, you also introduced the word meme into our vocabulary. M-E-M-E for people who don't know the word meme. But now we use it to refer to any idea that spreads in society, any kind of idea. How did you first intend the word meme to be used?
Oh, pretty much in exactly that way.
You did?
Yes.
It wasn't a biological word.
No, I mean, it's being used widely on the internet in pretty much the sense I originally intended. I never intended it to be a contribution to the study of human culture. It was just a way of drawing attention to a possible analogy between genes and memes and units of cultural inheritance. And it was also intended to press home the point that Darwinian natural selection only requires some kind of high-fidelity replicating code. DNA is a very good example of high-fidelity replicating code, but maybe there are others, and I suggested memes might be an example.
Any particular meme you're following with interest these days?
Let me think. I think that religions are clusters of memes. I'm trying to think. We did try to invent one and pass it around. I can't remember what it was now. Wingnut. The word wingnut as
to be used in a political sense.
To be used, yes, in a sense of some mad, crazy fundamentalist who believes in I don't know, the flat Earth, or believes that the world is only 6,000 years old, or something of that sort.
Caught on. People use I hear it on I think I hear it on right wing and left wing talk shows.
Yes, good.
To refer to the other all
yes.
the time.
Yes.
So that meme caught on. Yeah. Of all your books, at least from what I've read, The God Delusion is your bestseller, not your science books. Does that surprise you? Does it make you happy or unhappy?
The God Delusion has so far sold more than 2 million copies in English and has been translated into about 30 languages. The Selfish Gene's probably sold about the same number, but over a longer period because it's more than 30 years old. So, yes, The God Delusion is certainly my fastest-selling book, and I'm delighted about that, of course. It's widely believed to be a strident and shrill and aggressive book. It actually isn't. It's quite a soberly written book.
Do you think you've got the religionists on the run? Maybe you, together with Christopher Hitchens
certainly
and some other people.
Alone.
A lot of
yes.
books like this have come out.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I think there is a sense in that. I mean, after The God Delusion came out, there were at least 20 books published with titles like The Dawkins Delusion, Deluded by Dawkins, etc.
But also some that agree with you.
Yes. I mean, the ones that agree, I'm not talking about. They were not inspired by mine.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the 20 or so books that were directly inspired by mine, as you can tell by the titles and as you can tell by the jacket design, which was in many cases almost identical to the God Delusion's jacket
yes.
design, but with a with
ripping
a
you.
So that suggests to me that probably we did get them on the run. We have got them on the run, yes.
Why the label humanist, by the way, which is the other label that you use, atheist or humanist? And we see humanist societies everywhere. I know people who are culturally identified Jews but don't believe in God, and they meet in a group on a regular basis called the Jewish Humanists.
Yes.
But why humanist rather than naturist or scientist or something? Because humanist sounds rather speciesist. You know, putting people above all the other creatures who are also here through natural selection.
That's a very good point, and it's not a word that I often use. But the organizations that call themselves humanists are organizations that I associate myself with. I mean, they are set up to live without religion, but they put a positive spin on it. They're trying to say how we should live a moral life, how we should live a good life without religion. And so I do identify with the organizations, but I don't actually use the word myself, largely for the reason you've given, that it does sound very speciesist.
Richard Dawkins, my guest for another few minutes here on WNYC. His new illustrated, or we really call it a graphic science book, right? Illustrated has an older connotation. Graphic science book makes it sound more like graphic novels that are, you know, set like comic books with very contemporary illustration, which this is, pop or edgy, as you called it, just for people who are newly tuned in. The book is called The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True, by the best-selling author of The Selfish Gene and The God Delusion and other books. From our webpage, Michael on Staten Island asks, is there a moral theology compatible with science?
Yes. First of all, could I say, after what you've talked about a graphic novel, there is also an app for the iPad, which can be downloaded for the iPad, which contains the complete text of the book, plus the illustrations, plus various sorts of games and simulations. Now, the question from Staten Island, was it?
Is there a moral theology, and I don't really know what that phrase means, but moral theology compatible with science?
Well, let's say moral philosophy, and of course there is, yes. And moral philosophers from Hume and Kant onwards have indeed been providing us with that. So let's not call it a moral theology. What we choose to call moral is something that changes rather rapidly as the decades go by. We've now given up slavery. We're now much more sensitive to the rights of women and of gay people and so on. These are all reforms that most decent people would welcome, and they have not come about through any kind of theological change. They've come about through a change in the zeitgeist, which is secular and independent of religion.
We just have a minute left. Are you political outside your advocacy for atheism? I read that you were involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement in Berkeley back in the 1960s. Anything current?
Yes, I was involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement in Britain. I vote liberal and sometimes Labour, so I suppose I am of the left politically. And in American elections, of course, I strongly support the Democratic Party, and I wish they were more liberal than they are.
Richard Dawkins, again, his new graphic science book for readers of all ages. It's called The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.